You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Why should your right to freedom of speech trump a trans person's right not to be offended?
Because in order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive. I mean, look at the conversation we're having right now. You know, like, you're certainly willing to risk offending me in the pursuit of truth. Why should you have the right to do that? It's been rather uncomfortable.
Well, I'm very glad I put you on the spot.
Well,
I'm
great,
but
you get my point. You get my point. It's like you're doing what you should do, which is digging a bit to see what the hell's going on.
So,
and that
you,
is what you should do. But you're exercising your freedom of speech to certainly risk offending me. And that's fine. I think more power to you as far as I'm concerned.
Hello and welcome to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Thank you so much for coming on the show with us, listeners. We have a special treat for you today. If you told me 10 years ago that a Canadian psychologist was going to rocket across the cultural landscape and divide people into loyalists and haters, I may not have believed you. And if you told me a year ago that the same Canadian psychologist had checked himself into rehab, after a decade online, I might have been jaded enough to believe it, but there's no doubt that Jordan Peterson has left some kind of mark on the cultural and intellectual landscape, up to and including the way Christians engage with and think about society, religion, science, Disney movies, and a host of other topics. Lexham Press has assembled a spectrum of Christian thought on Jordan Peterson into its recent volume, Myth and Meaning in Jordan Peterson, A Christian Perspective, edited by Ron Dart. Hunter Baker, the author of the chapter on Peterson's politics in this volume, joins us today to talk about his essay and about Jordan Peterson in general. Dr. Baker is Dean of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, where he lives with his wife and children and attends First Baptist Church. He is also an affiliate scholar with the Acton Institute, a fellow of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and the author of numerous books on politics and religion. Dr. Baker, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I want to start not with Jordan Peterson, but with cultural criticisms or cultural questions. First, I saw on my social media feed this morning that you think the best animated superhero series of all time is why don't you tell us what you think that is?
Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes.
Now, I've got to ask, have you seen the 1990s Spider-Man animated series?
You know, I may have seen an episode or two, maybe by virtue of Disney Plus. My son may have had me watch it. It's tough. There have been so many iterations.
Sure.
Of Spider-Man that I can't be sure that I saw it, but maybe I did.
Okay, so it may just be ignorance here that leaves that off
now,
the list.
Hold on a minute. Now, have you seen Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes?
Well, here's where I'll be speaking from ignorance. I haven't.
Well, then stop. You need to just watch it because you'll immediately bend the knee when that happens.
I will add that to my list, not least because I have kids who are coming into that age range. I suppose we should also ask, are we including Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in this running, or do they not count as real superheroes?
You know, I will say this, I am actually the owner of one of the early issues of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the comic.
Okay, okay.
I may have, like, I don't know, issue number 12 or something like that. I really liked the first movie that was ever done on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, it was great.
I don't think I really paid much attention to the cartoons.
Okay. Okay, that's fair. I was raised on Ninja Turtles and Ghostbusters were my meat and potatoes when I was growing up.
Wow.
The cartoons. I mean, the movies were excellent too, but the cartoons. So, and this is not off topic. Jordan Peterson would very much appreciate us talking about, although he would also want us to get into the myth and the Jungian archetypes.
That's
and so
right.
on.
What are the archetypes or whatever that are represented right. by these characters, that sort of stuff.
Which Avenger, which Ninja Turtle are you, and how does that define your life, and so on. Well, I do want to start talking about this book with kind of the elephant in the room here. And you didn't write this part, but I do want to get your feedback on it. The intro of the book says, quote, "The task of any mature person is how they bring together theory and practice in the personal, communal, and public. It'll be interesting to see where Peterson goes, whether he makes this transition and how, or whether he has his moment in the sun and fades from view," end quote. Given that Peterson does seem to have faded from view, is he someone that we should still be paying attention to? Or to put it another way, was his book dated the moment? Was this book dated kind of the moment it hit the stores?
Yeah, my view. I will say this: when I was asked to write a chapter in this book, I did not have a huge exposure to Peterson prior to doing it. You know, as soon as I was approached about doing a chapter in the book, I thought, I'm going to have to watch a lot of YouTube videos. and I did that. What I had known him from was I had seen him interviewed by a female journalist on maybe the BBC or...
This is Kathy Newman, right?
Exactly, yes. And and I had been extremely impressed with the way he carried himself in that interview, because I thought that she was extremely provocative, tried to take everything that he said in the worst light possible. And yet I thought that he completely maintained his cool and answered in a substantive fashion and did a great job. So having seen that, I was encouraged to take on the task. And he has gone through some tough stuff lately. My understanding is that his wife has cancer, maybe terminal cancer. And he is quite close to her. You know, they seem to have a very close family. His daughter is highly involved in all this somehow. But also, you're talking about a guy who has spent the past, gosh, I don't know, what, 3 years maybe, as kind of an extremely famous person. And in particular, his normal community of esteem is the academy. He's Ivy League educated, teaches at McGill in Canada, which I think is maybe the best university in Canada. and so he has operated at an elite level as an academic. And so then he has spent these past 3 or 4 years completely at odds with the direction of the elite academy, right? You know, he has been fighting on this sort of transgender front. That's where it started. I mean, there have been many other things.
Right.
But I would just imagine that he's been under tremendous pressure. His speaking schedule has been crushing. So I'm not surprised he maybe had a little bit of a nervous breakdown. It's funny, if you read about Abraham Kuyper, who was an amazing person, founded a political party, founded a newspaper, edited a newspaper, was a pastor, was a theologian, ultimately founded a university, ultimately became the prime minister of the Netherlands. But if you look at his story, Kuyper would burn himself out repeatedly, and, you know, have to go spend 2 months at a sanatorium or whatever like that, recovering. And I think that's kind of what's happened to Peterson.
Yeah, and I certainly don't intend any slight against him personally, just the observation that we, for I assume that reason, we haven't seen him publicly really at all discussed. I mean, I'm sure there are still people who are watching, discovering the YouTube videos, but certainly not in the same kind of broad cultural way that even 6 months ago he was still around.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know if his big book is still selling, right? The 12 Rules book.
Right.
that was at the top of the bestseller list for a significant amount of time. I don't know if people are still benefiting from that or not. They may well be.
Yeah, and again, I should have done my homework on that before before looking this up. I'm sure it's still selling well, but again, is it that same kind of meteoric level? And I'm glad you mentioned Kuiper. We're both reading Kuiper this summer, so we'll have to have you back on for that. He is one of the interesting guys that I agree with, like 90% of what he says, of what I've read so far, but that 10% I disagree with is really important. So we'll come back to him maybe. To your chapter specifically, Jordan Peterson, The Counter-Revolutionary, Marxism, Postmodern Neo-Marxism, and Suffering. And here's the other bit of cultural engagement that I wanted to bring up. I love that you begin your chapter with a Dean Koontz quote. I thought that was great. And then I saw that it was a modern Dean Koontz novel from what I like to think of as his preachy era. So that's maybe less great. Contemporary Koontz is just so heavy-handed that I struggle to enjoy him.
Boyle, you need to read his... I agree that he is preachy in his modern books, but I like it because I view him as an ally, right?
He is certainly on my side politically and kind of philosophically, but I think he's committing the sin... I forget what Stephen King calls it, but he's putting the message before the story. Like he is,
But Coyle, these books. Think about the millions of copies these books sell.
Yeah,
and listen, there are people out there who have less refined taste than you, who will never get this message any other way.
Well, I'm praising Dean Koontz. I don't know if we can say I have refined taste, but.
But my point is that there are a lot of people who will never get this message any other way than buy something like what he's doing.
Oh, sure, but he got to the place where he can sell those millions of books by just writing really good stories.
Yeah, and, I hear you.
And he feels like he's stepped away from that.
I am a big fan of his Odd Thomas series.
Oh, yeah. maybe excluding the last
series
one.
Where I draw the quote from is his Jane Hawk series, you know, his... which I have to tell you, whatever else you want to say about it, it is a ripping good read. It's extremely suspenseful. You know, I just bought the books one after the other. I read the fancy books, but I like my pulp fiction also.
Hey, I'm right there with you on that. maybe we'll have to have you back on for a Dean Koontz episode. Let's just talk through your essay. What is a counter-revolutionary? And you're free to reference Kuiper here if you want to also, because that would be appropriate too.
Well, let me start with Peterson. The thing that you understand about Jordan Peterson after you pay attention to him over a long enough period is that this is a man who is extremely shaped by the totalitarianism of the 20th century, and in particular the Soviet communist totalitarianism of the 20th century. Peterson is mystified by the fact that everybody can agree that that Hitler was bad, but lots of people give a pass or don't know about. Say Stalin and Mao, or maybe Pol Pot, you know, people like that, and so he looks at the ambition behind the communist experiment, and he understands how people would get a lot of sort of psychic payback from embracing that or whatever else, but he insists on looking at the cost of it. And, you know, so he just looks at a century where so many lives are lost, so many people forced to live meager existences, all in the service of this kind of ideological vision. And he is reacting against that, right? You know, he is reacting against the whole sort of Soviet Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist conception of the human being. And the way that ends up getting cashed out in terms of government politics.
So, if I'm one of those, let's say I'm one of those people that Peterson's responding to, and I I don't know about Stalin and Mao. And my response might be, well, I don't care about that because right now capitalism is what's really causing people to suffer. Right, capitalism is what's leaving people in poverty, and leading to the oppression of corporations, dominating the lives of the workers and not paying a living wage and leaving people behind and so on. Maybe 50 years ago communism was the problem, but that's not anymore. Now it's the wealthy and the businesses and the one percenters and so on. And Isn't communism, but sort of a modified socialism a proper antidote to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things to say. The first is that if we want to kind of look at the scoreboard, you can talk about your capitalists and top hats and your one percenters all you want, but in terms of simple human flourishing, there's no question that the age of capitalism has been superior for human flourishing than any era before it, at least if we're talking in material terms. Right. Even a liberal economist like John Kenneth Galbraith, his most famous book, The Affluent Society, and basically what his argument is that without saying it quite this way, is that capitalism has been so successful, we can begin to re-examine the way we distribute wealth, right? The way we spend money, because we have, you know, the dream of economists has been that at some point you become so wealthy that these political questions almost won't matter anymore, right? And I think maybe that will be true. I can imagine it. But at some point you can intervene in that process and you can try to do away with capitalism, and the result tends to be very bad. And I think that's what we've seen so far, right? Now, yes, the argument is there some sort of alternative? And Peterson would say that what we've seen is that the Marxist socialists have attempted exactly to pivot. They recognized before the fall of the Soviet Union, even, they recognized that as an economic model, Marxism was essentially failing, right? And so he sees them doing this pivot from the economic to this sort of diversity or identity politics kind of a thing, right? So he would say that they understood their own failure.
Yes, it's probably not a coincidence that Gorbachev, when he was ousted from power, came to the United States instead of to China, right? I mean, he chose to go live in the capitalist society rather than in the communist society. Right. There may have been other reasons
Another way to put it is there are some natural experiments in the world. One of them is Korea, right? North and South Korea. You have the same genetic people with the same sort of history and cultural inheritance, and then a sharp break about 60 years ago. Right. What do we see since that time, right? You know, the more capitalist model versus the more Marxist socialist type model, the difference is vast. Or, to put it in terms that we can understand, would you rather have spent the past 60 years in Puerto Rico or Cuba? I think we know the answer to that as well.
Yeah, even accounting for the hurricane, I would imagine we still
even
know the
accounting
answer to
for
that.
The hurricane. Yeah, yeah.
So you've already started talking about this, but how not just economically, but what sorts of Marxist arguments in the contemporary world is Peterson responding to?
Well, so he talks a lot about neo-Marxism or postmodernism, you know, things like that, and people get all wrapped up in that, and they want to criticize him for not delving deeply into postmodernist theory. That's not really what he's trying to do. What he really means when he talks about postmodernism and neo-Marxism is he's really talking about the pivot from sort of a workers of the world unite sort of a thing to this race, sex, sexual orientation kind of a frame, right? You know, from from viewing the oppressors as primarily economic to viewing them as primarily white male, or something like that. You know, the idea of attempting to form a coalition for the overthrow of existing power structures, but in different terms than workers versus capitalists. So that's what he means.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit more about oppressors, right? Again, kind of still dealing with the people he's responding to. What are oppressors, and what is the view of them from that other side before we get into Peterson himself?
Well, so I kind of need to introduce his concept of suffering. Is that okay to bring
that
up?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, he's fascinating as so. So one of the things about Peterson is that people always wonder where he is religiously, right?
Right. Half of this volume has to do with that.
That's right. And he's pretty clear that he's not a Christian. But at the same time, he is deeply versed in the Judeo-Christian story. And it's very interesting. I think that he is very touched by the concern that many Christians have for him and the affection they have for him. But he talks about the sort of the Christian account of suffering and sort of the socialist Marxist view of suffering. And in the Christian view, and this will sound a little bit unorthodox to people as they hear it, he basically says that Adam and Eve are not human beings the way we think about human beings, at least not until the fall, right? You know, pre-fall, they don't really have needs. They are totally well provided for. We could even bring in Kuiper here, because Kuiper views Adam as this extremely powerful kind of an individual, right? You know, able to command gigantic animals and things of that nature. But so Peterson basically looks at Cain and Abel, and so Cain is sinful, right? And Cain succumbs to his envy of Abel. He is angry that he fails by comparison to Abel, and he develops this murderous rage, right? And that is what he sees as one of the big problems, right? Is that people allow themselves to be captured by this resentment, that someone else is making them suffer. But see, so for him, Cain is somebody who fits over on the other side. Cain fits on that kind of socialist Marxist side. In comparing himself to others, being unhappy with the results, and then kind of formulating a narrative accordingly. But for Peterson, the Christian account of suffering is that to suffer is simply part of being human. That after the fall, human beings suffer. And that's just part of life. And part of what we do in this life is we address that suffering, right? We try to address the suffering in our own lives, and we try to address the suffering in others' lives. You know, we can actually help people to deal with the suffering in their own lives. And, so this can be sort of something that we do together, that we recognize it as kind of a universal human experience. But on the other side, that sort of socialistic account, the way he would have it, is that instead of viewing suffering as a natural feature of human existence, suffering is viewed as something that is imposed by other people, right? Some other group of people. This is where we get into the oppressors. And so if we can identify who those people are, whether it's the capitalists or the white men or, you know, the cisgender male white men, whatever, we can take the power away from those people, and we can give it to other people, and suffering will cease. That's kind of how he sees things happening.
Right, with Cain and Abel as sort of the archetypes, right? To use his language there. Does that mean that there is so if we're taking kind of the able side or Peterson's view that suffering is just a part of human existence, does that mean that there is no one to blame for suffering and it just kind of exists, or is there a role for responsibility somewhere in Peterson's view?
I think that he would easily accept that that human beings are sinful, right? And human beings cause each other to suffer, but he would not accept any analysis that locates the source of that suffering in some group of human beings, right? That it's not the capitalist's fault or it's not the white man's fault, right? It's simply something that exists. It's part of human existence. And actually, if you think about economists, economists would argue something like that scarcity is a natural feature of life, right? Scarcity is not something that human beings cause. It's because we simply don't live in an infinite dimension of resources.
Right.
Same kind of idea.
And I guess the reason I want to hesitate a bit on this is because I agree that that suffering is a part of human life, but there is suffering that just happened. We're living in the middle of a plague, right? And as much as I would love to be able to blame this on, you know, one nation or one whatever, realistically it just kind of happened, and there's, you can't really assign blame. Although I do think Trump missed a golden opportunity. Instead of calling it the China virus, he should have called it the socialist virus. And would have been so much better for everyone involved. So obviously that does happen. But groups do also cause suffering, right? And I think socialism is a great example of that, right? The communists did cause severe suffering in the Soviet Union and in China. The Nazis did cause severe suffering in Germany. Capitalists can cause suffering, although so far it has not been on that scale anywhere.
Yeah.
So groups clearly can cause suffering. So again, where do we work that in?
Well, what he's worried about is the hubris of kind of taking my group, whatever my group is, and assuming that when my group gets power, the suffering will stop, right?
Sure.
You know, that my group that my group is different. That's where he locates the fatal flaw of the socialists. You could think about I'm trying to think about who was it, Voegelin who said don't immanentize the eschaton.
Yeah, Voegelin popularized a National Review by William F. Buckley.
Right, right. But so that, you know, the idea that anybody can bring the millennium, right, you know, through their sheer goodness, you know, that sort of thing, he's rejecting that.
So I completely agree with that, but how do we respond to again, the argument from we'll pick the Bernie supporters, not that they matter now because Bernie's out, but who say, look, we're not trying to solve the problem of all suffering, but things will be a little bit better. There will be slightly less suffering if only democratic socialism is you know the thing we implement.
Well,
right?
Peterson is probably not as far from somebody like Bernie Sanders as you would think. What he's really rejecting is a very strong ideological frame. Okay. But Peterson is a Canadian. His expectations about social welfare are extremely consistent with typical Canadian expectations. It's just that he's happy on that front to operate out of simple prudence and not out of some larger ideological frame. Right. I mean, what he wants is he wants a society where merit and competence are the primary values. And now that can look like big government. That's fine. Right. It's just that he doesn't want this kind of ideological program where somebody is telling you that you must you must identify a biological male as a female or you must see white men as oppressors, you know, that sort of thing. Right. He's very from his perspective, centered on prudence merit, performance, you know, those sorts of things. You know, so he talks about things like maybe a Middle Eastern woman coming to Canada and being stunned when a bus arrives exactly when it's supposed to arrive, right? You know, he says that's a kind of a miracle, right? You know, and the only way you get to that kind of a place is to have a certain kind of society where a certain kind of merit is prized, a certain kind of competence is prized, and that what we're looking for from governments is to deliver on those sorts of standards as opposed to according to these sort of heavy ideological standards.
Yeah, and I guess that's getting us into the question then of how is he a counter-revolutionary? Like, what is his practical program the other direction? So if we're working, sorry.
What he really is a conservative, right? I mean, he is a I don't think I wrote this way, but there's a sense in which he's a little bit of a Kirkian conservative, right? You know, kind of rejecting ideology, you know, prizing prudence, that sort of thing.
Yeah, again, we still have to run into the question of, all right, well, we have to have kind of practical political steps that we take, right? The coronavirus must be responded to somehow. And to say, well, we should do what works is sort of begging the question, because, well, what works for what, right? What is the goal? Even if we are rabidly anti-ideological, which I am perfectly happy to take that position, you still have to have some kind of vision guiding your policy.
Yeah, but that's not what he's addressing himself to, right? I mean, Peterson is not a public policy wonk or something like that. What Peterson sees is that, you know, so here he is. I mean, the way he came to fame, other than his ordinary academic sort of fame, is that they had this. I'm suddenly blanking on the name of the. The name of the bill,
it's like C-16 or something like that.
C-16, right, which required you to address a person by their preferred gender, right, regardless of what their gender actually is. And he rejected that. And the reason he rejected that is that he felt that that the state was using ideology to force him to reframe reality, that they are literally telling him, you cannot operate on the world as it is. You cannot think, you cannot conceive of sex as it actually is biologically, right? You have to react to what we tell you. Sort of like if anybody ever saw the famous miniseries from the 60s, The Prisoner, right? You know, Ian McGowan, the village, where all of reality is completely constructed, right? And you know, the guy who is constantly trying to break out, he insists on certain fundamental realities that cannot be dictated by ideology. That's what Peterson is trying to do. He's not going to tell you, you know, he's not going to give you the Milton Friedman type, you know, oh, here's the negative income tax that you need to use instead of the welfare state. Or something like that. He's simply telling you, it's almost like a separation of church and state kind of a concept. He's telling you that there are certain things that we cannot yield to the state in terms of what it can dictate to us in terms of how we construe reality. Something like that. That's what he's saying.
Okay. No, that's fair. I think when that law inevitably comes here, I plan to just get familiar with the second person pronouns, right? That's going to be my default.
I'll just call people by name. I'll always call them by name.
Well, assuming you're allowed to do that, right? What if they identify some other way? We've touched on suffering, Marxism, postmodern neo-Marxism. Should Christians, academics, Christian academics, should we be continuing to engage with Peterson? What good is Peterson for us?
Well, I have shown that BBC interview that I referred to students.
Sure.
And the reason I showed it is that that one of the things that I am constantly trying to get across to my students is that I want them to learn how to engage in disputes as a thinker, right? Not as a pure partisan, but somebody who stays calm, somebody who thinks carefully about things, somebody who's able to formulate a response. I think that there have been times where he has been a model of civic discourse. Another thing is that I think that some of these things I've been talking about in terms of your response to ideology, to grand ideological theories, I think that he's very good on that. I think that he's basically right in terms of the way he encounters it. Whether he's going to come back or not, I don't know, but I would view him as a valuable part of the conservative tradition. I think that he gives us a new way to think in kind of Burkean, Kirkian terms that would be very accessible to a lot of people. In fact, we know he's accessible because of the number of young people who watch the videos. So I would continue to engage him.
No, that's fair. I think he is. I don't know if he'll come back or not, but he is certainly a good model, right, for how to interact with others. And that interview was a great example where he specifically answered the questions that he was asked. He did it in a way that was respectful, and in a way that engaged Kathy, much to her later chagrin.
You know, another thing, Coyle, is that his. Something that fascinates me about him, something that I find very attractive about him, is his compassion. You know, if you sit and watch so many of those videos like I have done in order to write this chapter, his compassion is evident. I mean, this is a man who he feels things deeply, right? I mean, he is not blithely discoursing, you know, with no care for the troubles in people's lives. He feels human suffering very deeply. He wants to address himself to it. He wants to help people to take some ownership of their lives and to be accountable, not in a way that is judgmental or harsh, but in a way that's simply like, you know, look, you can wreck your life in this murderous rage that you have toward other people who you blame for your suffering, or you can think about reality differently. I think that he's a nice model in terms of his compassion as well.
Well, anything else to add about Jordan Peterson or Dean Koontz or the Avengers?
Gosh, the Avengers, the thing that I would add is that Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes was followed by the horrendous Avengers Assemble, which does not deserve to be in the conversation. So let me just add that warning. It's just two seasons, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And I was challenged by somebody else that the Batman, the animated series, is actually the greatest. It was certainly the greatest in its time, I'll say.
It has stood the test of time pretty well. My wife and I rewatched some of that, again, getting ready for kids old enough for that. That and the Superman and by Batman, I assume we're both talking about, again, the early 90s.
That's right. And, you know, what followed the Batman series, Batman Beyond, was actually quite good, too.
Yeah, I've not seen that one.
You need to.
I probably do. I haven't watched a lot of cartoons since I stopped being of cartoon age, and I need to get back, excluding The Simpsons and King of the Hill, I suppose.
This is the great thing about having kids that get older. As my kids, you know, reached a certain age, my son was really into comics like I was. And so he has given me an excellent excuse to re-enter that world.
I'm looking forward to my kids being old enough for that and trying to get ready now by watching some, going back and watching some of that.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Baker, thanks so much for coming on the show. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show and our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast. Get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And pick up Myth and Meaning in Jordan Peterson from Lexham Press, edited by by Ron Dart. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.